Today is August 23rd, 2003, and colleagues, the order of our agenda today will be Senate Bill 943 first, second will be House Bill 3528, third up is Senate Bill 183, and fourth is Senate Bill 772. And in essence, we're trying to at least get 943 out quickly because no amendments are anticipated. And if that's the case, then we'll be able to get a vote on the floor on it this afternoon still. So with that, let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 943. And I'll ask Senator Jason Atkinson to come forward and explain the bill to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jason Atkinson, state senator representing Southern Oregon, and I appreciate you allowing me to come and testify very briefly on this without my bill file. As we're tracking things down, I just thought I'd explain all the history behind the bill that you have before you. Let me tell you, it's been about 2 months that we've had a working group together to get this bill in this particular shape to you. There is a real crisis among small and actually all contractors, but it first came to my attention on smaller contractors, and then as we started to develop this working group statewide, we learned how big the problem was. And essentially, there's two problems. In Oregon, we require liability insurance on our contractors of $500,000. California has no requirement, and Washington has $250,000. So off the bat, we had very few insurance companies that were willing to write for Oregon companies. After 9/11, they saw a huge increase in what the fees were costing and a decrease in what it covered. So, for instance, as I said on the record yesterday when I carried this bill, we had one contract with $1 million worth of coverage. The coverage went up to close to $800,000 a year from $83,000 a year and covered less than $1 million. Smaller contractors, for instance, one I believe from my district was 38. They saw the premiums jump from $38,000 up to $24,000, $25,000, and their coverage dropped from $500,000, which is required by law, down to less than $250,000. So what we did is we sat on the workroom and said, how do you fix this? Well, the problem is that as sine die being imminent, we knew we had to have relief. We worked with the Construction Contractors Board and also with the insurance division, but there was really no clear line of how to get there. And so what you have before you today is a bill that will allow those two groups, namely our agencies and with close connection to the legislature, Construction Contractors Board, and the insurance division, we give them the flexibility to go and try to find a remedy, which the working group will continue. But what we're trying to do is give the flexibility to those two groups to find a remedy that we can live with. Will this be an issue next time for the legislature to review in 05? Yes. The reason why 943 is before you today is that we feel such an urgency, and the industry feels such an urgency, we don't think we can wait till 2005. Various reports that we've heard in our committee was how many contractors are going out of business or losing their insurance on a weekly basis. The number is staggering. I have one of my contractors in my district who is pulling out all of their business and moving to California just based on the insurance issue. So we have confidence. I have confidence as a senator in our counterparts, the Construction Contractors Board, and also commitments with the insurance division to get to a workable solution. But at this point, and knowing how we need to act, we brought it to you in this forum to get something moving, to allow some freedom in the process and to give some authority to come up with something workable. Let me just pause and move forward real quick on what we think it could be in 05. In 05, there is interest in doing similar to what Nevada has done, but that would take significant uphill education of legislators and a big work group that we just frankly don't have time to do. That's one idea that's on the board. Another idea that's on the board is getting rid of moving more to a California model. One of the other compromises was moving to a Washington system of cutting in half, and then another thing was self-insurance. I mean, can we pool small to medium-sized contractors to allow this to occur? All those things are on the table. There's obviously pluses and minuses access to each of them. But what 943 does is it allows Construction Contractors Board and Insurance Division to work together to get some relief right now. And that's what we're doing. There's another bill that has already passed through the legislature that we hope will also start to reduce some of those insurance rates. And I'm sorry, after 4,000 bills, I don't remember what the number is, but essentially it had to do with the liability chain in a class action lawsuit, and that bill's already passed all the way through the legislature and gone to the governor. So this is a real issue affecting real people, and I'm very proud to bring it to you, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Berger?
Yes, thank you. Sinjak, I guess I want to really understand exactly what this means. This means between now and 2005, whatever the two groups come up with will be acceptable. Is that?
I believe, can I turn around with all due respect,
sure,
and get a nod from somebody?
Sure.
Right?
Yes. It's not nodding.
All right, Scott Berry.
For the record, Scott Berry with the Oregon Building Industry Association, and I might just read one sentence out of the bill. As long as that alternative provides equal protection that is currently provided by the insurance policy, so there couldn't be a drop in the protection for the consumer. Aside from that, yes, an alternative that the insurance division along with the CCB came up with would be acceptable then as an alternative. But it does have that one caveat that it does need to provide equal, an equivalent or more of protection to the consumer.
Okay. Follow it, please.
Follow it.
But part of the problem here is that the $500,000 is excessive, I gather. So that's been a problem, but you're not changing that. You're saying that if you find some other means of securing this and protecting against the liability, but you're still going to keep it at that threshold. So that's what has me a little confused.
Chair Doyle, Representative Verger, that's true. We are not lowering the level. However, I will say that most of the contractors that fall under the general residential category actually have more than the $500,000 of insurance, and we looked at lowering the amount to $100,000 or $200,000, and frankly the cost savings was really not that great, maybe 15%, because it's the first $100,000 of insurance that's the most expensive.
Okay.
So that really didn't seem to get us where we wanted to go, and we did look at that though, and then kind of came back to this and said we don't have a solution today. If we find one in the next 18 months, we'd rather not wait to come back in 2005 and ask again. We'd rather have the authority with those two folks, to with the Construction Contractors Board in particular, to put that in play.
Okay. Thank you. I think I understand it.
I could just add one other comment there. The problem that we have found through the work group is not necessarily the $500,000 in coverage. It's the amount of companies willing to write the business. And that's what we're finding. We have one of my contractors, I think their policy's in Lloyd's of London. We just finding companies to write in Oregon was the problem. Part of the problem. If there's no more questions, I'm carrying a bill. I'll sit tight.
Hey, Representative Flores.
Oh, very quickly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Atkinson.
Yes, ma'am.
You indicated $500,000 for Oregon, California model zero, did
yep.
I understand you correctly? Washington, $250,000, and then you referenced a possible like to Nevada, and what did they do?
Can you give me a better explanation? Because we kicked it around for about an hour, and
we did.
Before you answer that, let me make sure there's no other questions with Senator Atkinson. Okay, thank you. Then you can take off.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Vice Chair. I'm going to excuse myself.
Chair Doyle, Representative Flores, the Nevada system would actually allow the state actually allows contractors to bid up to a certain amount based on the amount of security they have. So they set a limit based on the security that's provided by the consumer. So you might be able to, and that can range from small bids for remodelers all the way up to large bids for larger projects.
Thank you. Okay.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you, Ms. Berry. And we are in work session. Representative Forrest.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 943 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 943 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Both aye.
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 Chair votes aye, and Representative Close, do you mind carrying this? Okay. Representative Close will carry, and Senate Bill 943 moves to the floor with due pass recommendation. And that closes the work session on Senate Bill 943. And now open up a work session on House Bill 3528. And colleagues, before you are dash five amendments, and to explain that, I ask Representative Gallegos to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, colleagues. For the record, my name is Mary Gallegos, State Representative from House District 29, serves Forest Grove, Cornelius, and Hillsborough. Before you, you have the Dash 5 amendments, and I apologize. I did not keep a copy for myself, but they're very simple. This is a bill that we have seen in the House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee earlier. It's been in Ways and Means, and now it's here in Rules. A lot of discussion in this building about the public's purpose charges, which are consumers pay in the PGE and Pacific Core areas only of Oregon. A 3% charge is assessed on their electric bill, and they pay that. That is, program is administered by the PUC, which has utilized a non-governmental agency, the Energy Trust of Oregon, which has no governmental oversight of those funds and their use. Frankly, the consensus of many people who I've worked with on this is just to eliminate the program entirely. But we think we found a good resolution that actually helps keep the program intact, does not change it at all, would just move the oversight of those funds from the PUC and the Energy Trust over to the Department of Energy. And by doing that, the Department of Energy already does, for the state of Oregon, many renewable and conservation grants and programs. They could administer this in the same way they do their other programs. There wouldn't be any fiscal. It would be very minimal because they could use the funds the same as it has already been set up that the Energy Trust is able to use. They can still continue to use the Energy Trust, should that be their choice. But the contracts that are issued by the Department of Energy versus the Energy Trust, the Department of Energy contracts are public record. They would be subject to audits, and all the oversight that I believe the public wants of their funds. So I would encourage your support to help provide a little bit more oversight for consumers in the PG and Pacific Core areas to have their hard-earned dollars that they are paying be a little bit more scrutinized in how they're using it, and that we actually get what our intent in those funds are.
Okay, questions, Representative? Representative, just then on page 8 of the bill, of the amendment.
Well, the only change is just who can use it, but there is some old language that has been eliminated that's no longer necessary anymore.
Can we get another copy of the amendment?
I don't have a copy of it, I'm sorry.
I guess I'm just, what I want to do at least is focus in on the bottom, the part that's emboldened, that it looks like it's a process where the Office of Energy is making some determinations. Can you just kind of walk us through that? How is it they're making, or what are they making determinations on?
Well, this is just allows them to use a non-governmental agency, so they could continue to use the Energy Trust as that relationship is currently set up. That way, if they wish to continue the contract through the, because there are many programs that the Energy Trust are currently administering, and they could pick those up and use them with a clean transition is what the intent there is.
So at the top of page 9, where it's talking about a non-governmental entity, that's the Energy Trust?
Right, or any other non-governmental agency that the Department of Energy currently might have administered contracts with, but...
Okay. That answers my question. Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gallegos, am I right when I say or when I ask that this bill would do two things, at least pretty dramatic things? One would move the oversight to the Office of Energy, and two, the public purpose charge would go away January 1, 2008?
Yes. It would move the oversight, but the sunset was already in there. That is not anything new to change the sunset. That sunset was something that I believe was already
purpose,
in there.
On the public purpose charge.
Yeah.
Okay. Further questions?
Follow up. Mr. Follow-up?
Yeah.
And the proponents of this amendment feel that oversight would be better if it was an energy as opposed to PUC?
Well, right now, the use of the energy trust, and we've got several letters, where we have had a variety of communications. They are a non-governmental agency. We have no ability to require them to provide our documents unless through a legislative body like the committees or whatnot would subpoena them. We cannot request that information. It is not available for public oversight. We've been given permission to come over there to their office and sign non-disclosures if we want to review how these funds are being used, who the contracts are with, where they're at. Our understanding is many of these contracts that they are issuing are being issued to companies that are Washington, D.C., Colorado, California. This is Oregon tax dollars that are being sent out of state. And I think Oregon tax dollars and taxpayers would like to have the money used here in state.
Further questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, have there been complaints or about how the public purposes money is being spent? The schools get a certain percentage, and that goes to the ESD.
That's correct.
And then the rest of this as programs, the PUC being the rate regulator seems to be a natural fit to me. I'm not argumentative here. It just seems like a natural fit. And to change it, unless do we have some problem here, I guess.
Well, the problem that many of us have had is in the way the Energy Trust operates. Yes, the PUC regulates the rates, and probably the natural fit is the collection of the dollars. However, the Department of Energy does the renewable programs and conservation programs in the state. So what the Energy Trust is doing is renewable energy and conservation programs, which are not necessarily part of what the PUC's responsibilities are.
All right. We will hear other testimony.
No, this is it.
Mr. Chair?
President Barnhart.
Thank you. I note that the PUC Commissioner Beyer is here and also representative of the Governor's Office, and I did have a question or two of them, if I may.
No, this is the only invited testimony that we're having today. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Close.
Representative Gallegos, I'm just looking at Section 2 there at the end. I just want to make sure the wording that is there on the last page 9. To be clear then, if the Department of Energy decides they will continue to use a non-governmental agency, then they still can be audited and there still is a public records law operating. Is that correct if they continue to use a non-governmental agency?
Yes, they would administer that. They would have to write their contracts with them and specify how they would do that.
So are they required to do that in that contract?
No. And we have not required it.
Okay. Further questions? All right. Thank you for testimony. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3528.
Representative Flores moves adoption of the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3528. Discussion. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would simply note that, to my knowledge, that I've been informed that the Governor's Office opposes this bill, and that there is some additional information that the PUC could provide about the administration of the current system, and I intend to oppose the bill.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Monsanto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I truly believe that the way the system's set up now with the PUC, their primary interest is in ratepayers. If there are problems, I think that we should be dealing with PUC rather than making an entirely new change in with the PUC funds.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bridger.
I'm happy to consider Representative Gallegos' amendment. However, I feel with limited testimony, I will oppose the bill.
Anything further?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you. This issue seems to me to be a fairly complex one, and I'm having a difficult time in having to vote so quickly. I think I'll make maybe one of those decisions where I'm willing to vote it out of committee and then have more time to think about it between now and 3 o'clock.
Actually, it'll go a little later than that because it is an amendment, so we won't be hearing it today.
Yeah, okay.
On the floor.
Okay.
All right. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
No.
What's on?
Aye.
No. No.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move.
Oh, sorry.
Oh.
-5 are adopted. Members, of course.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3528 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves House Bill 3528 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
No.
Chair votes aye. And we'll ask Representative Gallegos to carry this bill. And 3528 then moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation. That closes the work session on 3528. And we'll seeing Senator Starr here, we'll just take the agenda out of order, and instead of 183, we'll just open up a work session on Senate Bill 772. And Senator Starr, can you come forward and explain the bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the House Rules Committee. Appreciate the opportunity to testify with you in front of you this afternoon. For the record, I'm Senator Bruce Starr, Senate District 15 in Western Washington County. Appreciate, Mr. Chair, you scheduling the bill for a work session this afternoon. This bill, I just want to give a little brief background. This bill, the genesis of it, is a Senate bill that was passed and championed last session by Senator Bev Clarno, with Senate Bill 966, that created the Innovative Finance Advisory Committee. The bill was not very specific in what it required ODOT to do, but ODOT really took the bull by the horns, and with the governor's appointment of some really key qualified people from all over the West Coast to look at how Oregon can create a statute to allow moving forward on this whole idea of innovative finance as it relates to transportation projects. That committee met over a series of many months and issued a report, and the report was the genesis of this bill that you have today. What this bill does is it creates a situation at ODOT where if you have a private company, a large construction company, that has an idea. They have an idea about how to build a transportation facility. Not only how to build it, but how to finance it using private capital and private dollars. And what it does is it creates that environment wherein that company can walk in the door and knock on the door at ODOT and say, hi, I'm X corporation or X construction company. We have an idea about how to build a transportation facility. It could be a road, it could be a port facility, it could be a rail facility. And they can walk in the door and ODOT can say, come on in. Come on in, let's sit around a table and let's negotiate and see if we can negotiate a transportation deal. to build a facility and to private fund it privately. Currently, there's no statutory ability for ODOT to welcome that company in the door and say, let's sit down and talk. In a nutshell, that's what this bill does. Pure and simple, it opens the door so ODOT can say, come on in and let's talk. It doesn't guarantee that ODOT and this company, any company, can come to an agreement, but it does allow them the opportunity to say, let's sit down and talk. What kinds of protections are in this bill as it relates to kind of Oregon's way of doing business? This bill will not allow ODOT to get around land use regulations. Will not allow ODOT to get around environmental regulations, either state or federal. Will not allow ODOT to get around kind of the public hearing process that Oregonians, I think, hold pretty dear to them. Those kinds of caveats are in this bill. We have to maintain kind of the same process that's available in our regular SIP process. Really what this bill does is it puts a tool in ODOT's pocket to say, Come on in and let's talk. How can we build some fairly significant transportation projects when we don't necessarily have the public dollars to do so? Well, this allows those conversations to take place. The bill has been worked and reworked and works some more, particularly from the Department of Justice. They had some concerns about this. This is a new way of kind of doing business, and so they were very concerned about, you know, what these contracts are going to look like. Is the state going to be protected, et cetera, et cetera? And we've worked with them, and there were several amendments that we adopted as we worked this bill, both on the Senate Transportation Economic Development Committee and in the Subcommittee on Transportation Economic Development of Ways and Means. Where we are today is there's unanimity as far as support from the stakeholder groups, the governor's office, the Department of Justice, the employee unions as it relates to the public employee side and the construction, the trade side. The business community, I think, is excited about this. I am here to say that I think that this is an exciting opportunity for Oregon to put this in place and provide a situation where ODOT can, I think, in the future do some pretty exciting things as it relates to transportation projects in the state. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have. And Jim Witte is in the audience, and Jim is kind of the staff person both for the Innovative Finance Advisory Committee and, at ODOT, and has worked on this bill as well. So if there's any real technical things, Jim can help with. But I'd be happy to answer any questions. There are some conflict amendments, I think, that you have because there's some conflicts with House Bill 2341, the public contracting bill that went through. But short of those, I think those are the only amendments that wouldn't necessarily need to be adopted.
And, Senator, those conflict amendments you discuss are contained in the amendment, the dash B-15s, and no issue to you with these?
Okay. Shouldn't be a problem.
All right. Any questions? Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Stern, on page 2 of the ANGRAs, where it references 279, I guess I'm a little concerned, and I have a question about the competitive bid process. If this bypasses those statutes, then and the agreements are made, will there be competitive bidding for the project? I guess it's on page 4 in the being room, and it's section 4, subsection.
Mr. Chair, Jim Witte can answer that directly if I haven't come to the microphone.
Yeah, come forward, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Witte with ODOT. There must be competitive bidding in some manner or form for any project that involves federal highway funds. This is a requirement of a federal rule. So, in fact, to the extent that state-only funds are used, we would anticipate doing the same thing, although that's a rarity, that we only use state funds for a project. So competitive bidding will be part of the process. It must be.
No follow-up.
Competitive bidding is part of it unless it's only state funds. So what percentage of projects would that be? Is that our local city streets and things like that?
Local city street, that would be, they have their own processes. This does not govern what they do. This is only ODOT's work, which is, say, highways. So I can't tell you what the percentage is. I'm wondering if Mike Marsh is behind me. Mike, can you help with that?
If I may, Mr. Chair, many cities have state highways that go through them, such as Albany has Highway 20, and it is a city street, it's also a state highway.
Mr. Chair, Mike Marsh from ODOT. Regardless of whether state funds or federal funds are used, it will be a competitive process. That's what we're ensuring.
Follow-up. But in the bill, it says the provisions of ORS Chapter 279 do not apply to concepts or proposals submitted under Section 3 of this Act.
Mr. Chair and Representative Close, we want to ensure that there is a competitive idea of what the marketplace would offer if there's a proposal. So this process makes sure that we have to go out and determine what is the market for this particular project and know what others would pay for it. So we have to get that information.
So you're saying that's already in the bill, that you're required to get that information?
Mr. Chair and Representative Close, yes. Plus, we'll do administrative rules that follow up to clarify those elements of the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make a comment that I think that public-private partnerships are the way that we should go. I think it's an efficiency matter. I think it's a way that the state can be more astute in their planning by bringing in, and we may have, to our surprise, a lot more play from the public sector than we know at this time, because we've not really reached out to them through the department. So I'm very supportive of this.
Okay. Any further questions on this panel? All right, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Flores. To adopt the B-15.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the B-15 amendments to Senate Bill 772.
Representative Flores moves adoption of the B-15s to Senate Bill 772. Any discussion? Not. Any objection? Not. So ordered. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 772 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 772 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the Senator for coming to talk with us individually before committee, since things are seeming to happen very, very quickly. But I also concur that the public-private partnerships are so important, and if it's going to save Oregon taxpayers' money and the Oregon system money, we need to have this option, and I support it.
Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Chair votes aye, and we'll ask Representative Flores to carry this bill to the floor. Senate Bill 772 then passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. That closes the work session on Senate Bill 772. And we open up a work session on Senate Bill 183. And colleagues, we have an amendment for you. It's the -A5s. Senate Bill 183, and this actually is a fix to a bill that's already been signed by the governor, Senate Bill 179, and that is also included in your packets as well. And what I'll do is that I'll ask Sue Schneider to come forward to just give us Chrissy Monson as well, just give the explanation of what the unintended consequences were of signing off on Senate Bill 179.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Susan Schneider, the City of Portland, thank you for this opportunity. Existing law allows for the application of double fines in school zones when children are present and the zone is appropriately posted. When children are present has proved to be an unenforceable standard. Nobody really knew what it meant, especially drivers. And so legislation in the form of Senate Bill 179 was passed by both bodies and has been signed into law. And it has new standards for school zones on local streets. Those are the streets that are normally posted for 30 miles an hour or less, when the school zone is normally 20 miles an hour or less. And now school zones on local streets, as a result of a work group and all the work that went into passing this bill, the school zone speeds are posted 24/7. In other words, it is the speed limit, not just when children are present, but all the time.
Well, I meant to at least talk to you in advance on this. Just as for purpose of clarification, Section 5 of Senate Bill 179 provides that children are present any time on any day as far as dealing with this issue, but it's only when children are either occupying or walking within a crosswalk, waiting on the curb or shoulder of the highway at the crosswalk, or a crossing guard basically is there. So it's not, unless there's another issue to this, that's, I guess, what I was saying is when children are present, that this would be enforceable.
Sure, Doyle, members of the committee, that's correct. However, the crosswalk defined in that section is only a crosswalk that is not adjacent to a school. So,
well, and that's the point of the correction here, but I, you know, one of the concerns I had even with trying to fix this bill was that when you go through a school zone, basically 24 hours, 7 days a week, that you could still be cited if you were going beyond that. And my understanding now of the bill is that that's not totally the case, that children still have to be present, you know, under those conditions.
Mr. Chair, that is true of 179 when it goes into law, but it also means that then there are no, basically, times when the fine would double on these local streets, and so the amendment is to deal with that piece.
Exactly, that's just for purposes of clarification.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your help. Thank you. And a judge, of course, always has the discretion to say that a double fine is inappropriate. So certainly, if you were cited at 4 o'clock in the morning, and you know you're going 40 miles an hour, the posted speed's 30, and the school zone speed's 20, a judge could say, well, that's not reasonable to fine you double. So that's always appropriate thing for a judge to do. So I would draw your attention to the amendment at the bottom of page 2 and 3. That's the part that doubles the fines for only the offense of speeding, because in other cases of doubling fines in school zones, it applies to all offenses. So this is narrowed just to the offense of speeding.
All right. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I'm not quite clear here. I know of people that have received fines for speeding at 3 in the morning in a school zone where there are not children, and the judge did not have any mercy on that. So I want to make sure that it isn't just left up to the judge, because obviously they are faced with increasing revenue shortfalls and are increasingly unwilling to reduce fines.
I guess just to clarify too for members, what the 179 has already passed into law. That basically now makes it, I mean, if children are present at 3 in the morning at a crosswalk, you know, in a school zone, then it's considered a school zone even though school is not in session.
Right.
So that's been covered. What has not been covered, and all that we're trying to fix here with the technical amendment, is the way 179 applies right now, as I understand it, it is only on streets that are not connected to a school. So it's like this, the roads that are, any other road that's just not connected to a school. So what this technical fix does is apply the fines to on school zone roads that are actually connected to schools.
Okay. Whether or not children are there.
Yeah.
Well, in compliance with Senate Bill 179. So this supports Senate Bill 179. that if, and again, and that's why we provided Senate Bill 179 for you, is when you look on actually the second page, top of the second page is Section 5 that says basically when children are present, and then that emboldened area provides the definition of when children are present.
Ah.
So I guess part of this is that we are not undoing Senate Bill 179. We are just making sure that traffic fines can be doubled in on school zone streets that are connected to a school.
Okay.
That's all we're doing here. And I didn't mean to interrupt you, Representative Close, so if you have further questions.
I appreciate that. If you would just walk me through the A5 now and show me where you're doing that, I will be happy.
And Ms. Monson, you need to identify yourself for the record as well. So if you wanted to do that.
Thank you, Chair Doyle, members of the committee. My name is Christy Munson. I represent the League of Oregon Cities and was on the original work group on 179.
Chair Doyle, Representative Close, the A5, the relevant piece is on the second page at the bottom where it says, for purposes of this section, a traffic offense described in Section 2A is committed in a school zone if the offense occurs while the vehicle is in the school zone. Notice of the school zone is indicated plainly. And then that if you go down to A, B, and C, these are what define it as local streets. There's a posted speed of 30 miles or less, the speed limit of 30 miles an hour or less. There's a speed limit of a speed of 30 miles an hour or less is prima facie evidence of violation of the basic rule. So it limits it just to those local streets, and that's what we're concerned about is the local streets. And that's where most schools are, on local streets.
Further questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Horace.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Dash A5 amendments to Senate Bill 183.
Representative Forrest moves adoption of the Dash A5 amendments to Senate Bill 183. Discussion. Note as well, colleagues, that this is a cut and stuff to the original Senate Bill 183, and the original Senate Bill 183, we have learned from the Department of Transportation, was just taken care of in a vote, concurrence vote, I believe, by the Senate yesterday. So there's no need for this bill, or for that original bill. Any discussion to adopting the A5 amendments? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 183 as amended to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 183 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye, and we'll ask Representative Barnhart to carry this bill. And that closes the work session on Senate Bill 183. And colleagues, you noticed we had one more item slipped in on the agenda, so we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 494. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 494 without recommendation to the Special Committee on Budget, and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 494 without recommendation to the Special Committee on Budget, and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Any discussion? Representative Moss Anderson.
Yes, this bill will prohibit publicly funded employers from using public funds to assist, promote, or deter union organizing. And this is this would apply to the use of state funds. Is that correct? I mean, am I
there's no changes whatsoever to what the Senate Bill 494 engrossed was.
This is moving straight as is from the Senate
to us.
Now, through us now to this Special Committee on Budget.
Okay.
All right. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye. And that closes the work session on Senate Bill 494. And colleagues, at this point, not knowing yet what's still coming over from the Senate this afternoon, we are going to just recess, and we will be back in touch when we know if we can come back today.
Okay, we've got to bring.
And open up the House Committee on Rules and Public Affairs, and nothing further before the committee. We are adjourned.